This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week we're joined by Por Hyong Hong, a scholar and researcher currently based at the Center for Poverty and Development Studies at University of Malaya. Welcome.
Yeah, hi.
Fuad. And today you're going to talk to us about the politics of healthcare, particularly focusing on the historical developments after the Second World War.
Yes.
What comes to mind when we combine the terms together, Sharat, politics and healthcare?
Well, you know, I'm immediately thinking, you know, who gets included, who has access, class issues. I mean, these are the things that immediately spring to mind when I think of politics. Also, the way the state views healthcare, whether this is a right or is it part of the marketplace of services that somebody can avail themselves of. So those are generally what I would think.
And we take that for granted, right? Because we often think that going to the hospital is apolitical or innocent. But when you really think about it, there's a lot of documentation that goes on. There's a lot of gazing into private spheres that goes on, that you're asked to confess and share certain intimate details. And when you really pay attention to the kind of exchange and interaction and sharing that goes on, you are effectively opening yourself up to the mercies of either a capitalist or a state institution.
Actually, immediately after World War II, we know that the entire Malaya was dragged into this counterinsurgency. So if you read the existing literature about healthcare politics after World War II, you know, there was always this glossing over about that the healthcare in Malaysia today was shaped by the dynamics during counterinsurgency, but nothing really said about what happens during that period. Actually, a lot of things happened during that period, including, you know, the use of healthcare as a tool to control political affiliation. What does it mean by the use of healthcare? Because if you look at the development of new villages, you know, new villages is a space completely like is a zone that is not just bodily movement, but health services and medicine and even food are heavily controlled.
Mm-hmm. So this would be like the hamleting, right? The idea that I think it was a strategy developed in Palestine, brought to Malaya, the idea that you would physically separate civilian populations from combatants. So the idea that they were distinct in terms of the population, right? And this happened all over. The remnants of which, of course, are some of the most juicy and primest properties in the Klang Valley, right? The old new villages are now hot property, aren't they?
But just can you just give our listeners a bit of context? What was the healthcare infrastructure like after the war? Were there hospitals as we know it? Was it just clinics? Can you paint a picture for us for that context?
During the Japanese occupation, a lot of some of the hospitals they were used for experiment, including some biological biological weapons experiment, and that part of his history is not really explored yet. Mm-hmm. But we know that that there was this kind of things happening. But so actually, a lot of health services was almost not really functioning well. Mm-hmm. So, but then immediately we were already in the counterinsurgency, and in the counterinsurgency, a lot healthcare was not there. Actually, it was not there, and a lot of money was used to for warfare rather than for reconstruction.
Yeah. I mean, this is extraordinary, right? Because you're talking about like biological warfare and all that. And I was thinking we were going to hear a story like with a Malayan Florence Nightingale. We would hear of, you know, how the colonial powers came. They built modern medicine alongside. Yes. There was this parallel system. Yeah, maybe traditional, whatever. You know, you'd have your midwifery, modern midwifery against, you know, the old Mabidan kind of system. And then, you know, we all learned to develop together, and it got better and better and better, the emergency notwithstanding, right?
Yes.
But that's not what you're saying. That's something entirely different.
No, it's not that. The picture is not that it's not like that at all. If you look at the history of new villages and also the history of in the rural area of the predominantly Malay rural area as well, there was a lot of discussion then and debate then regarding how to rebuild because there was none. Almost none existence. So people were talking about how to build healthcare. But then, interestingly, during 1948, civil war in China just ended. So there was this huge army of missionary, 7,000 of them, over 7,000 of them, suddenly gone out of job. Mm-hmm. So they have nowhere to go then because they were they have to leave China. And it was this moment coincided with our counterinsurgency. So actually, Henry Gurney and Gerard Templer, they actually saw this as a chance, you know, so some of the missionary, they were invited to serve in new village. That's how they fill the void of healthcare in new villages. So missionary healthcare came in to fill such void.
When you said void, you use air quotes, which is not available for our listeners on radio. So I mean, the void you're saying was actually not that it was missing. It was in some ways it's constructed, right? This is colonial policy reimagining these spaces, including the new village. Is that correct? That healthcare is not a necessary part. Healthcare supplied by the state is not a necessary part of the landscape.
Yeah, but at the same time, almost during that time of period, we know that there were also this discussion about welfarism started after World War II, right? So the British, they were also concerned about their own image. You know, they cannot, they want to build a good image, so they don't want to, they need some sort of, so they started to talk about winning hearts and minds through providing certain services, social services, including education and healthcare. But then they were reluctant to provide, to really put in money on those kind of infrastructure. So the missionary army in China actually gave them a chance to fill that void. That's what I meant.
But it's interesting, the thing about the colonial period, right, what the colonial powers did or did not do. I think it's been argued that in many ways the colonial state was marked mostly by kind of benign neglect. They just didn't do anything. And as a consequence, civil society had to blossom. It had to fill, service needs. So schooling, especially with the Chinese community, it created its own schooling system. You know, they created their medical halls and whatever it is, right? They provided for themselves. And the displacement of that by the colonial state now wanting to provide services for their legitimacy is then, you know, is a precursor to the independent developmentalist state, again, muscling out civil society and, you know, securing these things as their own, right? Legitimacy.
Yes. So actually, what we the legitimacy of whatever nation state that we know today, you know, they have is always linked and associated to being able to meet some sort of promises that they have made, and this include welfare. That's why, welfare. There's always this question and issue about ideology behind welfare. Why are you promoting welfare? In what context you are promoting welfare? And it's not just that all welfare or welfareism is always good, because there are always this issue about why are you promoting welfare at this particular historical juncture, and for what purposes? That's the question that I try to ask in my work.
And because the time was so contentious, right? Something as supposedly benevolent as healthcare becomes a foil for, like you said, funneling certain ideologies and certain messages to the populace. What was the local reception like? Was there a critical attitude towards these measures, or was there resistance? Was there an attempt to question this outreach that the colonial government was trying to do?
I would have to say that there are really little recorded or documented stories about how about the people's response. But if you look at, the later so-called development of these places, these new villages, it seems that it's people are just, I think they have different views. I wouldn't say that there is just one view, you know.
Because one of the ideologies that comes with state welfarism, especially in the post-colonial developmental push, was the idea of science, right? The idea of their medicine being better because it's more scientifically oriented. But we know, Malaysia being Malaysia, that more traditional forms of medicine, more, you know, I guess, indigenous types of healing were prominent before these institutions were built. Was there a tension between that, between so-called kind of state-centered, kind of scientific, Western-oriented medicine and the already prevalent practices locally?
Yes, yes. It is always there, the tension between indigenous healing practices and the imported ones. But the landscape is actually very complicated in the sense that we have the indigenous healing practices, but we also have some... The imported ones are not just the so-called Western biomedicine. You have the Chinese and Ayurvedic ones. These are... It's very difficult to talk about
Sure.
Yeah, because how are you going to frame this today, you know? But in our TCM regulation today, actually, Ayurvedic, Chinese...
They're all considered
traditional medicine. Traditional medicine is a way to, it is a less contentious way in a sense.
But can also be appropriated by the state in some cases.
Yes, exactly.
Like the famous endorsement from the Deputy Minister of Higher Education for the 8,000 ringgit Sihir kit. So, to fight black magic. I'm just wondering, because right now there's so much, you're talking about so much of unrecorded history, it seems. What were your resources in trying to piece together your argument? Because you just can't look at newspapers or the archives necessarily, right? I mean, because you're looking at discourse.
Yes.
So it's not just the documented facts or numbers, but how they are interpreted. How did you piece together your data or your resources?
I think the strategy that I've been adopting is like reading against the grain, because I have to admit that I rely a lot on official documents, but at the same time, I always take it with a pinch of salt, and then you read against the grain, and then because you have to take into account of a lot of the historical context, especially the colonial context, all the power and politics, all this you take into account, and you try to read against the grain. Because when you are at a stage that you don't really have those stories from the people, then it's very difficult. Then so reading against the grain is one way of doing that.
I know as a good scholar, you know your impulse is to make something simple complex, and you've given us a sense of the complexity of that story. What is the official and simple version of what's happened in this context? I mean, I did that, my own sort of fantasy, starting with Florence Nightingale, but what is the official story in Malaysia/Malaya?
The official story would be that, okay, the colonial government after World War II have been taking good care of the Malayan people. And then if you read Straits Times, all the news coverage during that period of time, they always showcase, you know, oh, this is the new village. And then they would pick one or two as for window play, you know, to display. It's like, this is what we have done. You see, we have school, we have clinic, but these are just the very few and rare cases, and then that's what they do. And they would say that, everything is doing well, you know, these kind of discourses. Mm-hmm.
And that's just followed up in the post-colonial period with the nation-state doing precisely.
What is more interesting is that there were also pamphlets, the anti-communist pamphlets around, and then some of the pamphlets, they actually show that those surrendered communists, you know, they are in the hospital, well taken care by the government, and then it's a way, you know, to persuade those still in the jungle, hey, why do you want to suffer in the jungle? Come out, surrender, and then you can enjoy healthcare in modern hospital setting. And then they use picture, you know, photos.
Do you read the work of people who've studied the communist movement, the insurgency, the emergency? I'm thinking of Han Su-yin, who was a doctor. yes. You know, the famous novelist who was also a doctor in Johor Bahru. And her husband, whose name I'm starting to forget, but anyway, I'll come to
Leon Komba.
Leon Komba, because yeah. He set up a special branch. You know, in the turning exercises they did with insurgents or members of the Communist Party, did these issues come out? What is, because in their vision of what kind of society they wanted, the new communist society, they must have had their version of the good society, the good state. You know, I mean, China had its barefoot doctors. They too were wanting to provide for the people, right? So this discourse was in some ways shared by all modernizing forces, whether it's colonial state or even the insurgent communists, right? They share the same view, right?
So far, I haven't really come across a more sophisticated kind of discourse or narrative about healthcare services from the communist side. But it's true that if you look at China, the story is different because they do come up with the idea of barefoot doctors and those kind of ideas. But there's one book called I can't remember the title of the book. It's about the 12 or 20 women in the jungle, and then they talk about some of the stories actually talk about their bodily experience, and then the MCP, Communist Party, they did have their own medical team, but the medical team was actually to serve the need of their own people, I mean of people in the jungle. They send people for training in China, in Vietnam, and as we know that there was this second wave of recruitment in the 60s or 70s. So some of them, they had the chance to went through training in Vietnam War. So, and they after that, they have a chance to apply what they've learned in the jungle.
Fascinating stuff. So you're telling me that some of the MCP members who were designated doctors here got training in Vietnam by the guerrillas there.
Yes.
And then brought back their skills here. Wow.
Exactly, in the jungle. But of course, everything was like, they don't have operation theatre, so they have to do it just on the spot.
Right, you know? Right. Fascinating story of an unacknowledged history of healthcare. But we'll take a pause right now for a brief break, and we'll come back to discuss the politics of healthcare in our historical context here in more detail for the second part of the show. We're joined this week by Dr. Por Hyong Hong of University Malaya, and I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Shahr Kutin as usual, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Shahr Kutin as usual, and this week we're talking about the history, or rather the political history of healthcare with Dr. Por Hyong Hong from University Malaya, who is a researcher with the Center of Poverty and Development Studies. On the first half of the show, we got a really rich sketch of how the politics of healthcare in modern Malaysia began amidst very, very precarious and difficult time in Malaysia with the insurgency, the emergency, the colonial anxieties regarding those things. But let's shift gears a bit and let's find out more about our guest this week. How did you become interested in this topic? I mean, it's fascinating, but it's something that's off most people's radar, right? So what drew you to it?
Actually, I myself had a background in healthcare because my first degree was actually in physiotherapy. So I'm always concerned with the issues of healthcare. But as I move on, of course, my own focus would shift from time to time. Yeah. So that's how. And actually, my second degree was in health and welfare policy. So and that's when I started to see the link between politics and healthcare, or to read healthcare as a site where there are actually a lot of politics going on, a lot of political dynamics going on in the arena of healthcare.
We know that you studied in Taiwan in those first two degrees, and your shift towards understanding of cultural politics, in some ways influenced by cultural studies in Taiwan. And the cultural studies in Taiwan is no mean feat. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, and there's some big names coming out of Taiwan. So could you tell us a little bit about the milieu? What exactly were the concerns of people working in cultural studies at that point in time when you started to shift away from physiotherapy into this kind of culture? multiculturalists
okay,
failed.
Maybe I give a little background of the time, what happened during the time that I studied in Taiwan. Actually, the period that I spent my life in Taiwan was in mid to late 1990s and early 2000s. And it was a time when social activism was the most, it was the most beautiful period.
Wow.
You know, in Taiwan, because there was including this sex work activism, these kind of things keep coming up, and then because sex work is another issue that where healthcare, sexuality all come together. Because when people talk about sex work, the reason for regulating it is always associated with public health, the spread of VD, venereal disease. So all this issue came as a struck. It struck me so much, and I started to try to think about a lot of things. And while engage in reading groups when doing my postgrad, reading stuff about cultural studies, including people like Stuart Hall or Foucault.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right. And then you moved to Penang, and you did your PhD work under Francis Low.
Yeah.
The Malaysia of the time that you were doing your PhD work, was it inspiring you? Was this topic something you negotiated with your supervisor, or was it something that you had already started thinking about when you were in Taiwan?
Oh, no. Actually, it took me a long time to got to what I really got to later, because the first few years when I was doing my PhD, I was really blank, because if looking at the Malaysian literature, the stories are just very simple. It's not as complicated, but I didn't really know how to rewrite that part of history. I wanted to rewrite, but I had no idea how to do that until later on. I started to pick up books, cultural studies stuff. Yeah, before that I was
periods of blankness, by the way.
It could
be most productive.
I agree. I'm currently blank right now, my PhD. I've changed topics for 4 times, so I can clearly relate. And it's inspiring to know you've come up with a really awesome study at the end. But you mentioned Foucault's name just now, Michel Foucault, a philosopher we've discussed a couple of times on the show as well. And he's famous for his book, Birth of the Clinic, which talks about a lot of the themes that you brought into your research.
Yeah.
To what extent did you engage his work? To what extent was it significant in your own thinking about the context here?
Because Foucault is complicated. I would say that I engage with Foucauldian framework rather than Foucault, because Foucauldian is different from Foucault. Mm-hmm. Foucauldian is whoever want to study, who focus much more on, especially there was already this pool of intellectual, they were using Foucault's idea to study healthcare. And so that there was this Foucauldian school. So that's what I rely on. Mm-hmm. And they started to to talk about how modern citizenship is actually articulated in instructing people to to relate their identity, their health with nation state, with the new state, with their citizenship, their healthcare, their health and their illnesses, and including their reproduction. Yeah, this is the idea that I engage in my own study. Yeah.
Interesting. Could we bring the discussion to the so-called post-independent setting? It's rather hard to ignore it, right? Because now we have the haze, where health is discussed very openly, very publicly at all levels of society, whether culturally or government. And then you recently, like you mentioned, Sharad, we have the typhoid scare. That's, I think, still ongoing. How would you characterize the so-called post-colonial development of healthcare? Does it follow the same patterns, or do you see something different happening, broadly speaking?
That's an interesting question, because when we talk about post-independent state, there is always this theme about nation building, development, and healthcare. And if you look at all the discourses, it's about how to create and build a healthy social body or citizens so that they can contribute to the development of the nation. In that discourse, you can see that the citizens' health is actually just a tool, an instrument for development, not the other way around. So in that sense, you are instrumentalized to meet development.
Yeah. I mean, what's if you do the comparison, right, during the colonial period, resistance to colonial instruction on health or whatever it is can be read as an anti-colonial struggle, right? It's almost too easy to kind of defend that kind of resistance. But once you come into the post-colonial period, there is, I think, a great difficulty. Because there does seem to be the disappearance of politics from the sphere of things like welfare and all that. Suddenly it's non-political. It is actually what we've been fighting the colonials all these years. This is what we wanted. So to resist the kind of modern, independent, post-colonial state, it's much more difficult than to resist the colonial state in terms of these kinds of interventions,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, because we have been... Yeah, one of the things that people were fighting against colonialism is to get their own welfare, to get their own modern healthcare, because especially medicine and healthcare, it has been... but this is not just peculiar to Malaysia, because in a lot of places, in a lot of post-colonial countries, they all face this problem because they want to. They have already internalized the image of the colonialist of the colonial state, that they want to be just as modern and as developed as their colonial predecessor. Mm-hmm. So there was this desire to become modern, and this internal desire is very difficult to resist. The temptation is always there. It's not temptation anymore. It's already become a desire of
the colonial subject,
Yeah, the colonial subject.
Can you
exactly
describe a bit more? Because that's a very interesting but delicate point. How have we internalized the colonial desire in relation to healthcare?
Because one part of the colonial project is they use science and so-called modern medicine to showcase that they are more superior than the colonial subjects or the indigenous people. Mm-hmm. So medicine and modern health services is always there as a marker of modernity. Mm-hmm. So in order to become modern, you need to kind of like build your own modern healthcare system. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, infant mortality rates, I mean, think of one matrix that's used over and over again to describe a country, right? We use infant mortality rates to in fact create a hierarchy of nation states.
Yes.
The most modern advanced versus the least developed. I mean, you know, infant mortality rates. But I do think, okay, we're going to move into the contemporary. We have just, you know, in this week alone, interesting stats that have come out on anti-vaccine movement in this country. So part of it is, okay, hysteria in the sense that there's suspicion that pig produce were used to create the vaccine. So that's one thing. But there's also a parallel argument about vaccines and autism. And so there's a, you know, already here we're showing a deep suspicion of the modern state and the expert, right, the medical expert. So Malaysians are not immune to this now interesting trajectory, the rejection of modern medicine because of either faith-based reasons or maybe conspiratorial ones.
Yeah, sure. But because the anti-vaccine issue is actually a little bit complicated, because we in Malaysia, we only see that, okay, because of the maybe some porcine elements in vaccine that some people are against that. But if you look at the context in the America, a lot of Christians, they are against vaccine as well. Mm-hmm. Because if you trace to the history of 19th and early 20th century, there was this wave of movement against vaccine, actually. And it was the idea is about some, because they have this religious assumption about vaccine is something external coming into your body and is going to contaminate your body. Mm-hmm. So because they have this assumption about the purity of your original body, so they don't want external, they were rejecting something external from their body.
Part of it too is that we have to understand that modernity is very elastic and it's always being reinterpreted and refashioned depending on how the distinct desires are confronting the infrastructure. So what we find now is a greater Islamization of the medical infrastructure itself, where there's discussions about whether or not female doctors should treat male patients are entering, whether or not they can have intergender skin contact without having rubber gloves. These were not necessarily modern colonial kind of discussions, but the kind of post-Islamist you know, or rather Islamist sort of developmentalist idea that you can use the modern state to incorporate so-called traditional demands. So I think that makes Malaysia's case very unique in that there's the interaction between modern and tradition is taking a certain form. We're still figuring out how.
Yeah, I mean, there is a kind of Marxist or maybe broadly leftist critique of big pharmaceuticals, you know, medication and all that, right? So there is, it seems, even in the contemporary world, resistance to the grand narrative of medical health and progress. You know, it's coming from different sectors, faith-based and then even the kind of political economy critical thing, right? The idea that somehow we're not being given the option to rethink our health, that health is taken away from us, we become, you know, powerless objects and we lose our, you know, our agency and such. So I think there are many critiques that are available, but the mainstream is still that narrative of progress, isn't it?
I mean, yes,
for
yes,
somebody like
yeah.
you documenting this long history, that would be the thing that you're fighting against. You're trying to complexify
yes,
that,
yes.
right?
But then I'm not I don't want to be taken like, okay, I'm against all this technology. No, it's just that I'm trying to put it into context about how technology has, this medical or modern healthcare technology has been used for certain political purpose. I'm not against sure. the technology per se. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are we making the mistake of being a bit too state-centric here? Because I feel that, especially in Malaysia, right, population control has gotten almost impossible because you have an increased influx of migrant workers and you have a lot of secrecy among in official documents, and university studies are not necessarily up to date when the, you know, population changes as a result. How does the Malaysian case complexify the, you know, added emphasis we have towards state and its mechanisms? Because I feel that there's so many things that even the hypermodern state in Malaysia cannot control to catch up with the how society is changing because of the demands of capital, right? So
yeah,
migrant workers,
yeah.
for example, they don't know. I mean, how does the state that's very nationalist, you know, with its Islamic attachments, deal with the other when it comes to healthcare?
I think the idea of controlling mobility over trans-border mobility is actually delusional. Is a delusion, yeah, that we are able to control, because borders are always porous, you know, people are always moving. And how you're going to define border is another issue, yeah. And so these are just, it's always in the government's discourse, but when it comes to reality, people are always moving. Mm-hmm.
And
legal
people are
or
evading
illegal.
As well, right? So
yeah.
you have, I think every time we have a MERS or a SARS or something, we know that the standard airport entry points are going to have those machines.
Mm.
But people are landing on the beaches of, you know, of Malacca from Dumai and, you know, or from, you know, Rakhine State in Myanmar.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're detected, sometimes they're not. And we know there's a fabulous system of evading medical checks, right? That, yeah. you know, the millions of immigrant workers. So you're right. I mean, in some ways, it both delusional, but it also feeds that other fear, right? So there is this constant paranoia that, and I think with the typhoid case, again, it was foreigners. Foreign. So the foreign elements
yeah.
of the body, like, you know, mm-hmm. like the dark side of that vaccine story, right? So the vaccine is put in for good. It's like little amounts of bad things help your body build resistance. This is like lots of bad things coming, and maybe resistance is futile. I mean, I don't know,
yeah.
right? But the medical, I mean, the fantasies and the dystopic nightmares that I've built around health are just extraordinary.
I think it all boils down to with us entering so-called modernity, we always have this desire to control what is to even control nature, and actually illnesses is a part of nature, but we are trying to control that. So that fear actually comes from this desire to control.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, I grew up in Singapore, and you can imagine as a state that, you know, has all its borders firmly, you know, tied in it. Well, everything is right? It's a teeth clenched Singapore. But the problem is when you talk about the haze, this is something that Singapore mm-hmm. is completely powerless.
Yeah.
Suddenly, They can't do it. They can't put big fans and blow it away. They can't put some diaphragm. You know, there's nothing. And I think that sense of vulnerability that is always the back of the minds of the modern man and woman, right? The idea that whatever we do, no matter how much we fight and control nature, it always comes back to remind us how vulnerable we are. I mean, yes, it is a modern condition, isn't it?
I think we're abstracting a bit, because if you talk about migrant labour, if you talk about the haze, there are concrete reasons for this, like capitalism, for example. And in Malaysia, that's where the wave is. It's privatization. Even hospitals are being privatized right now. I mean, there are more beds in government hospitals, but overall, I think the number of private hospitals nationwide have grown to outnumber public hospitals. How is capitalism also a regime of control in medical terms?
The hospital is not, because talking about private hospital, I think we tend to think that, okay, private hospital, they are just serving people in this territory. But if you look at medical travel, if you look at medical tourism, people actually crossing border to get healthcare as well. And without medical tourism, the private hospital sector in Malaysia are very much likely to collapse.
Wow.
This is not always talked about, that people are moving across border to get healthcare and to support the private healthcare sector in certain country, and that actually affect the healthcare in other parts of the region.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
like you have people from Indonesia, you know, they are able to, if they are able to pay for healthcare in other places, then they would move. But that would actually influence the healthcare back in their own country,
mm-hmm.
because they would have to treat just the so-called poor sick. So the rich sick, they would cross border. And right. That's another issue about capitalism and healthcare. And that, I wouldn't say that, that is not really an issue about the regime of control. But for hospital, another way of talk about the regime of control is that, it's always the rich people who are able to get these services in a shorter time. So that makes them more resilient than the poor people. And that means they are...
Not that I'm sick of the discussion. I mean, it's fascinating, but I think it'd be healthier to kind of pause now, because there's a lot that we have to think about given the two parts that and all that you've shared in it. And perhaps we can move to recommendations, right? The puns were intended, Sharad, but I guess...
I know.
But what can we read? What can our audience look up if they really want to know more about this field?
I would suggest Nicholas Rose. He has got one book called The Politics of Life. Yeah. And also now we have a lot of genetic engineering kind of trend.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a trend that has been going on around the world, including Malaysia is trying to... The Malaysian government is investing a lot of money into that area. Yeah.
I would suggest, I mean, just to quote Herbert Marcuse, you know, not every problem someone has with their girlfriend is due to the capitalist mode of production. And so I must kind of remind myself and others also of the great doctor socialist heroes of the 20th century. I think of Norman Bethune, a Canadian doctor who served in China for the revolution. You think of Che Guevara, you know? I mean, if you read Motorcycle Diaries, part of his impulse is, you know, as a doctor going and living in a colony of people with leprosy, whatever. So doctors have been kind of central to the modern, the modernist mythology, you know, and socialists, as much as, you know, capitalists, have used that or kind of travel with that. So I think it's just to remind ourselves of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in Malaysia, we also have Dr. M. Rajakumar.
Yeah.
He's Rajakumar, a great figure.
In fact, there are many doctors who are part of the socialist movement, part of the, you know, and, you know, we have who were in parliament as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have Dr. Mahathir.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have been blessed by doctors.
You know, Dr. Nasir, the president of PSM, is also an acupuncturist.
That's a local reference.
There's an interesting discussion in the History of Sexuality, Volume 1, towards the latter part, which is sometimes overlooked. It's about how the incitement to discourse of sexuality in Europe developed at a time when biopolitics was developing, when there was the broader discourse of managing populations of a growing nation state. That's an interesting way to look at how our sort of personal desires coincide with the broader changes in politics and society. So I recommend that book. Is there a way we can get in touch with you? Maybe through Twitter, maybe?
Are you on Twitter? Like
yes, mm-hmm. I'm on Twitter at FUXIANGHONG.
Okay, and mine is at Sharad Kutan.
Or you can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook. Just type BFM Night School on the search space. Once again, we'd like to thank Dr. Por Hyong Hong for sharing her fascinating research and its implications today. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharad Kutan, and you're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.